Hey, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Folks, you have no idea what you're missing. You're missing a couple of interviews. You're missing some great analysis by Digby when we talk about the news of the week. And it's all available to you for just pennies a day. Head over to ROFpodcast.com. Become a member. You'll support the free show. You'll support the show that gets on the radio because that business is kaput. And you'll hear more great content as well as having access to 10 years worth of archives. And that stuff is actually genuinely amazing. ROFpodcast.com. Check it out. Sign up. Become a member. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Cornell Professor Thomas Papinski will be here to explain why an impeachment fight might be scarier than we think. David Dayen from the American Prospect will list the House Democrats that Big Pharma calls upon to protect their profits. Heather Digby Parton will be here to help me run down this week's election results and the latest on the impeachment hearings. Lastly, our progressive candidate spotlight this week will be with Russ Cirincione, who's running for Congress in New Jersey's 6th District. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show. You can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show without commercials and access to over 10 years of our archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down the big news this week. Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, this is a crazy week in news. And what's fascinating about our starting the show by saying that is not that we're saying it, because we say that every single week. We have been saying that, it feels like, every single week for the last, I don't know, about 150 of them. Excuse me. Has it been 150 weeks? I think so, right? And it's been a crazy week. What makes this week different is that Donald Trump in no way is driving any part of this media narrative that we're going to be talking about. In fact, he is being run over by it. In both of the big stories that we have this week, one being impeachment, the other being the elections that were held on Tuesday night. Now, we'll go through the elections, but people should understand that I think that if what you and I have been saying for some time, and we're not the only people to be saying this for sure, that negative partisanship is going to determine the outcome of the 2020 election. Largely, and that impeachment plays directly into this. Certainly, everything that happened this week reinforces that. But let's talk about what happened this week. There are two big stories on top of, or, you know, sub-stories, I think, in terms of the stories that we saw this week. Maybe three. It's Kentucky, it's Virginia. Some respects, it's also Pennsylvania is telling us a story as well. There are other races around the country and other initiatives that have been passed. But those are the three big ones. I guess if we start in the reddest of the stories, we've got to be talking about Kentucky. Am I right?
Absolutely. And, you know, you can't ignore the fact that Donald Trump was there the night before the election, and the Republican governor there, who was, granted, he was an unpopular guy. People didn't really like the fact that he had destroyed their health care system and, you know, destroyed their education system. And, you know, he was having problems. But Donald Trump went down there and put the full force of his popularity among his vaunted base in the heart of a very, very red state and said, you know, if you love me, you have to vote for this guy. This was Matt Bevin, the governor of Kentucky, the Republican governor of Kentucky. And, you know, it didn't work. And there was huge turnout in the state on both sides. But it turns out that there were just a few more Democrats than there are Republicans in the heart of red America. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, all the pundits, you know, the vote, you know, the strategists are saying, well, you know, don't read too much into this. This doesn't mean anything. This is, you know, he was unpopular and, you know, you can't really, these off-year elections don't say anything. And, you know, of course, I don't think anybody observing politics at the moment is taking anything for granted. But you cannot ignore the fact that, you know, Donald Trump put his entire, you know, prestige and his reputation on the line with that, and it didn't work for him in a place where, if it was going to work for him, and of course a lot of these strategists were saying that impeachment's going to backfire, it's going to be like Kavanaugh, which they also said was going to backfire and didn't. You know, this is like, you know, they keep assuming that, oh, those Republicans, you know, they're going to come out in force if you do these things, if you impeach the president or if you protest against Kavanaugh, you know, it's going to hurt you at the ballot box. And, you know, we just have not seen any evidence that fighting Trump and fighting this radical Republicanism, you know, head on is something that is going to backfire for Democrats. It's the opposite. So, you know, I think that I disagree with this idea that this doesn't mean anything. We're right in the middle of this impeachment thing. If there was going to be a signal that this was a terrible, you know, thing and that Democrats really needed to back off and be cautious and, you know, think twice about going forward with this, I think we would have seen it in the ballot box, and we did not. So, you know, I think these pundits should just kind of back off a little bit on that.
Well, I mean, I'm not even sure I just think the analysis is wrong. I mean, you have Donald Trump won this state by 30 points. I just want people to think about that. 30 points. That's stunning in 2016. And you're right. He went there and literally said to all these people, if you don't vote for Bevin, they're going to say it's the worst loss ever in the history of the world for me. And, you know, I'm willing to accommodate him and allow him to have been right in that moment because I do think it's a huge loss. I mean, first off, just the idea, and he said something to this effect when he went to Mississippi as well, the idea that he has to go to these type of states,
yes,
is in and of itself indicative of a problem. This is, you know, there's no reason why a president would need to go into a state like that. Nothing should be this close for him. And it's fascinating in that regard. And you're right, Matt Bevin was specifically unpopular. He and Andy Beshear, you know, had the advantage of his dad, you know, having been governor. But you know, Beshear ran with the help of unions. He championed the parts of the Green New Deal that talked about coal miners and did quite well there. Bevin tried to, you know, tie Beshear to a crazy Bernie Sanders, as he said, and that didn't seem to hurt in any way. Beshear also was talking about supporting the teachers. This is where the red state revolt of teachers striking across the heartland of the country started last year. And, of course, it's also there was the big fight with the miners that was taking place, miners who hadn't gotten paid. I mean, there's a lot of cross currents of things going on there, but it is a really fascinating outcome that, and you know, people are saying that, you know, Mitch McConnell shouldn't be scared and this and that, and maybe that's the case. They're citing that one of his lieutenants won the attorney general race, but I don't think Donald Trump came and campaigned with that guy. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like there is an argument that Donald Trump brought people to vote against Matt Bevin. Never mind that he didn't help Matt Bevin, that he helped generate votes against Matt Bevin. And,
well, the final polls, I mean, I don't mean to interrupt, but the final polls had Bevin up 5 points in the last day. Donald Trump went down there and Bevin lost. So, you know, obviously that doesn't necessarily prove it, but it is evidence that suggests that maybe Trump actually hurt him by coming down there.
All right, look, we got to take a quick break. We've got a lot more to talk about going forward, because there was also something, and when we talk about Kentucky, that was really relevant, I think, that we need to discuss, and we're going to be discussing later in the program. But and here's a pop quiz for you and the listeners that you can answer during the break when we come back. What T-shirt was every single person on stage behind Donald Trump wearing when he was promoting Matt Bevin? We will give you the answer when we return. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Digby. Heather, when we broke in the last segment, we were talking about Kentucky. We were talking about Matt Bevin losing to Andy Beshear, although it's going into, it looks like a recount. When Donald Trump came down, we had mentioned Matt Bevin was up in the polls by 5%. Donald Trump comes down. I am quite convinced that it's very possible, and maybe we'll never know, that Donald Trump actually hurt Matt Bevin's chances in Kentucky by coming down and campaigning for him, which would be a fascinating outcome. We don't have voter numbers, the complete final vote tally, but anecdotally and eyeballing it, it looks like there was a lot more voters who came out in this 2019 election than the 2015 election. And not terribly surprising, but I think we're going to see that Democrats, registered Democrats, people who hadn't voted, showed up in a way that nobody anticipated. Now, the other story that is going to be relevant, I think is relevant today, but it's going to be relevant specifically in this show a little bit later, because we got a lot more voting results to take into account from Tuesday. It was the pop quiz that we introduced at the end of the last segment. It was, what was everybody wearing? The Trump people had handed out T-shirts, and everybody was wearing the same T-shirt behind Donald Trump as he was giving this speech in support of Matt Bevin. It was not MAGA T-shirts. Heather, I am going to guess that you know the answer to this. What did it say?
You could not miss it. They were all wearing it. It says, read the transcript. It just cracks me up because Trump had given an interview, and I can't remember who it was, maybe somebody on the Washington Post, I think. Oh, no, it was the Washington Examiner had gotten an interview with Trump a week or so ago. And he said this was his impeachment strategy, was read the transcript. I mean, he said that out loud, and he even said, and we're getting T-shirts. We're going to have T-shirts that say that. And I think you and I talked about this on the Majority Report, which was, you know, okay, great idea. I think, you know, the Democrats should put that out too, because reading the transcript, contrary to what Trump thinks, and honestly, I find this one of the most inexplicable aspects of his defense, and completely, even by his standards, this is just weird. If you read the transcript, you know, granted, it is not a word-for-word transcript, as he says, but, you know, you read the transcript, summary, memo, whatever you want to call it, it's clear that he was bribing the president of Ukraine in that transcript. And I just, the fact that he does not see that, that he cannot seem to grasp it, or somehow thinks that, you know, having everybody read the transcript, which of course he knows they won't, because these are his followers. They, you know, they don't read the transcript. They don't.
Well,
do
nobody.
That.
I mean, look, people didn't even read the Mueller report, right?
True.
I mean, people who had a problem with Donald Trump. I mean, so, you know, asking the American public to read, and they'll all pretend they did, is a good strategy. But The and yes, you and I were talking about putting those out. I actually had some fans on Twitter who came up with the idea of actually putting the transcript on the T-shirt. So it would end up being just read the T-shirt. But more importantly, this was a rollout, I think, of the Trump administration and the Trump campaign to see if they could leverage impeachment to their benefit.
Yeah.
And they
clearly
did not. They clearly were not able to capitalize on this. And I think, you know, we're going to talk about this because there was some earth-shattering information that was dropped this week in terms of the impeachment. I mean, I don't know that it was earth-shattering, but it was house of cards shattering to the Republicans' pushback. But we will talk about that later in the program. But that's, you know, that's Kentucky in a nutshell. You have a deep red state where Trump won by 30 points. He goes down there and he probably hurt an already weak Matt Bevin's chances of winning. And the impeachment was in no way an inhibition for people to come out and vote for the Democrat there. And so let's move to Virginia, where the Democratic Party has not controlled all three branches of government in Virginia since 1993, I think it was. Maybe it was 94. And but what is old is new again. Democrats were able to flip at least 5 seats in the House of Delegates and at least 2 in the Senate. And they now control both these houses as well as the governor's mansion. And we should say, like in Kentucky, you're going to protect the expansion of Medicaid, and you probably will get a broader expansion. Same too in Virginia. You used to have a Republican legislature. They had narrowed the eligibility for Medicaid in Virginia. That's going to go away. I think you're going to see a lot of things that happen in Virginia. And, of course, the biggest thing is they control the redistricting as we go into the 2020 census. So Democrats, that's a big big deal in Virginia. And, you know, I think you look at like places like Colorado, where when Democrats won there, they expanded voting rights or the ease in which they can vote. I would be surprised if we didn't see that in Virginia, because when more people vote, Democrats tend to win. Generally, that's the case. And so this is a big deal between Virginia and Kentucky. You know, people were hopeful and maybe somewhat anticipating this happening in Virginia, but I think it happened in an astonishing way. And you had Lee Carter, not only a member of the DSA, but really, I think, a legit socialist, win re-election in Virginia. You had Danica Rome, the first transgender woman to win re-election in Virginia, and you had races in Pennsylvania that we can touch on in the next hour, because we got to take a break here, that were also indicative of not just a Democratic victory, but a left-wing victory. We will talk more about that as the show progresses. Digby, if you'll join me in the next hour, we're going to take a quick break here, and I will be right back after it. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I am Sam Seeger. Just ahead, Ring of Fire regular and editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan. I'm Sam Seeger. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, today's show was made possible in part by BetterHelp. BetterHelp is an online service. It gives you unlimited access to your own fully licensed therapist by way of phone, video, and chat. And they're giving Ring of Fire listeners 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. That's BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. Look, this is how it works. You get paired up, and you'll be communicating with your therapist within 24 hours of signing up. You don't have to go into an office. You can do it from your home or wherever. If you're on the go, it doesn't matter. You can log into your account anytime and send messages to your therapist. You'll get a timely and thoughtful response. You can schedule your live meetings at any time that fit your schedule. And if you don't think your therapist is working out, if it's not a great match, you can switch to someone new at any time for no extra charge. It's more affordable than traditional in-person therapy. Financial aid is available. And you'll get 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Who does Big Pharma call upon in Congress when it needs a friend to protect their massive profits? Well, here to tell us how 11 conservative Democrats recently wrote a letter supporting a drug patent provision in the NAFTA update, David Dayen from the American Prospect. So, David, you have two pieces out this week at the American Prospect, as is... Well, I imagine you have a lot more, but there's two in particular I want to discuss. This one about pharma and about how conservative House Democrats are actually protecting drug company profits. But then I also want to talk about and broaden out and talk about the other piece that you wrote about the battle for progressive policy going through Congress and the various pitfalls, some of which were really on display. If folks out there watch Bloomberg News enough, they would probably have come across it. But before we get there, let's talk about this this letter that 11 Democrats have written in support for a drug patent provision in the, for lack of a better term, NAFTA update that most Democrats oppose. And I want to talk about first off, what's the letter?
Yeah.
What is this update?
Let's back up. So the administration last year signed this agreement with Mexico and Canada that would update NAFTA. It's called the USMCA, or the US-Mexico-Canada Agreement. And for the last year, they've been trying to persuade Democrats to get on board with it, because really it would only come up for a vote at the discretion of the Speaker, of Nancy Pelosi. And there are many things in the agreement that Democrats oppose and want to see changed, and they've been negotiating with the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer on those points. And one of the biggest sticking points is on pharmaceuticals. So in the new NAFTA, in the USMCA, there is a 10-year exclusivity period for a certain type of very high-cost drug known as a biologic. That is actually a lower exclusivity than the 12 years we have in the United States, but it's significantly higher than what's in Canada or Mexico. And this is just rent seeking, right? This is just protectionism. This is saying that you, drug companies, now have 10 years of essentially monopoly power to earn profits exclusively off this drug treatment without allowing generics to compete with you. And this is in the bill, and there are two problems that Democrats have with it. Number one, obviously, it raises those walls in Mexico and Canada and will make it more difficult for Mexicans and Canadians to access life-saving medications. Number two, it sets a bar within a trade agreement such that the United States, if it wanted to go below 10 years, might not be able to do so, because they're locked in to an agreement with Mexico and Canada that says it's 10 years. So those are the two problems with it. And the Democrats have been negotiating with Lighthizer over these points. And so here comes this letter from 11 moderate Democrats essentially supporting the Lighthizer position, the Trump position, on this provision on pharmaceuticals. So they are undermining this negotiation. There's a negotiation going on between Democrats and the Trump administration, and here's a bunch of Democrats coming in on the side of the Trump administration. It gives the Trump administration a much stronger hand in this negotiation.
And one of the Democrats is Sherry Bustos, who is the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee.
She's not named on the letter. But, however, what I would say is that six of the members who are on the letter four of them are freshman Democrats. And Sherry Bustos, the head of the DCCC, and she is in charge of getting freshman members reelected. I mean, that's a large part of her job. A lot of these members are in seats that might be vulnerable to not just being in a swing district, but primary challenges. And the DCCC usually comes in and tries to support incumbent candidates in those races. And so while Bustos isn't on the bill, she has been very loudly supporting bringing this agreement to the floor and giving it the vote. Whether the change that most Democrats are making the agreement or not, in fact, what she said in The Intercept is that unions and progressives, quote, will have to get over it if the agreement reaches the floor without the kinds of changes that they seek. So Bustos, while not on this letter, is very implicated in this whole thing of essentially undermining a negotiating position.
I mean, we're doing all this. She's saying that unions and progressives and whatnot are going to have to eat it over six Democrats.
Over 11 in all. But yes, there is this philosophy clearly from a lot of the leadership that the caucus has to go in the direction of its rightmost members, they have to show that those members are getting things done in Congress, working together in a bipartisan fashion. The idea, in my view, that some swing state or swing seat Democrat is going to get credit for passing a free trade agreement, particularly one that has implications for higher drug prices, it doesn't make any sense to me. But there is this sort of disease in Washington that says you have to show bipartisanship in order to win re-election. And this trade agreement has now gotten caught up in that discussion.
How real, how sincere is this? I mean, because this is going to be relevant for our mm-hmm. conversation after the break. But how sincere is this? I mean, is there a genuine belief that you need to show some of these voters in there that you're willing to work with Republicans and therefore they're going to vote for you instead of the Republican? Like, how sincere is that belief? Because to me, it sounds bizarre.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's sincere is that pharmaceutical companies would really like this provision to pass, and pharmaceutical companies have the ability to spend lots of money either on Republicans fighting Democrats for those seats or on Democrats directly. And by placating them with a trade agreement that speaks to their desires, you neutralize that potential source of funding against you, or you create a source of funding for you. And this has been the sort of Democratic way of the world since the 1980s, since it became a party that chases big money. And those calculations are never far from the surface, especially when you're talking about something like a trade agreement, which has a coalition essentially of industry in support of it, and often at the expense of workers and consumers.
And the thing that I still find stunning, and we will talk about this on the other side of the break, is if the Democratic Party has to give up a huge concession, right? I mean, drug prices, that is like, this is a top line thing.
Right.
And if progressives and unions are going to eat it, why are they doing it? Let's say all 11 of them lost their seats because of this, which I find hard to believe, but let's assume that that's the case.
Right.
Still, you still have a Democratic majority, and you have one theoretically that would be more durable because you're actually delivering the goods to the progressives and unions that you almost admit by default are driving the success of the party. We have to take a quick break.
You raised a great point.
All right, well, great. Then that's a great place to transition to our break and then come back with talk about your piece on the battle for progressive policy having to go through Congress. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to the great David Day, and we'll be right back after this. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking to David Day and about two of his pieces in the American Prospect, and now the battle for progressive policy goes through Congress. So, David, in the other segment, we were talking about a specific provision in a specific bill. This is the USMCA. It's the sort of the updated NAFTA provision. The Democratic caucus largely against it, or I should say at least the
there are certain provisions of it. Yeah.
This provision, and this provision would essentially protect drug company profits, but it is indicative of a larger problem that I think Nancy Pelosi made clear to all of us this week, where she went on Bloomberg Television, basically undercut. I mean, there. I have two problems with this. And we won't get to the first problem. We'll talk about the second problem, which is, you know, how do progressive policies get through a Congress with Nancy Pelosi? But Nancy Pelosi jumped into the 2020 Democratic primary this week. And I don't think that it was terribly, frankly, I mean, it was definitely unhelpful. But I think she should have been taking a lot more flack for this than she did when she basically came out and said, Medicare for all, no way. And on top of that, we got to pay for every progressive policy that we have an offset so that it's revenue neutral, essentially. And that is also basically saying, yeah, all this stuff that's aspirational, we're not going to do it unless it's really small bore stuff. I mean, that's she's getting involved in the 2020 primary as much as she is basically laying down a gauntlet saying we're not going to do anything progressive. If we get a Democratic president, I mean, what the hell?
That's the question. There's no question that she took essentially the platforms of two of the three top candidates in terms of support and trashed it. And if that's not putting their thumb on the scale at a Wasserman Schultz 2016 level, I don't know what is. I mean, it's very clear. And you're starting to actually see other Democrats come out and do this. Earlier this week, John Tester and Joe Manchin said, no way, no how, we would never support giving up the filibuster. You've seen Manchin say that he wouldn't support Bernie Sanders over Donald Trump. This is not isolated.
One thing when Joe Manchin says this. It's another when the Speaker of the House from San Francisco says this.
Right. She's thrown in her lot with the forces of capital, the forces of industry, who don't want dramatic change, who don't feel that it's necessary for their particular bottom lines. And one thing that I do bring up in that piece is that Nancy Pelosi is a lame duck speaker. She made this decision basically because otherwise she would not have had the votes to become speaker in after the 2018 election, to say that I will serve one or two more terms as speaker, and I'm going to serve this one, and then to serve the next one from the Congress, the next Congress, 2021 and 2022, I will need the support of two-thirds of the Democratic caucus, and that's the only way I'm going to serve. So the Progressive Caucus has more than one-third of the total Democrats in Congress in its coalition. There is a place for them to easily say, look, you need to stop undermining our candidates and depressing the rank and file of this party and making it harder for us to turn anybody out if the idea is that nothing is going to get done, or else we will withhold our votes for you for speaker, and you can't get them without us. So, I mean, there really is a legitimate – I mean, if she's going to go play hardball like this, there is a response that can be made.
Well, do you think that the Progressive Caucus is going to do it? Because if the Progressive Caucus won't do it, then why should she care?
I mean, I think the Progressive Caucus, or at least the leadership of the Progressive Caucus – I haven't talked to everyone in it, but I think the leadership is frustrated. I did happen to talk to the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, a couple weeks ago, and she did express frustration that certain members, who she did not name, but I think at this point Pelosi can fall into it, were using these talking points of Republicans and insurance companies in talking about Medicare for All. And she made the key point that look what happens when Democrats unite. So before Democrats and Pelosi in particular united on impeachment, there wasn't a large amount of support for it within the public. The numbers were, what, in the 30s, basically, for impeachment. As soon as Pelosi changed and said, yes, we're going to start an inquiry, those numbers jumped 10, 15 points.
Yep.
And it's amazing what happens when Democrats are actually united and speak with one voice on these things.
But
and,
doesn't Prayapal saying
true
that
with these other issues?
Yes, except for but there is a difference, and that is impeachment really is a purely political and civic, whereas Medicare for All involves the interests of big corporations. And so when Nancy
right.
Pelosi
no
is
question.
Doing this, this isn't, with impeachment, you could make the argument of I'm worried about those frontline Democrats and blah, blah, blah. And it's possible you could make that argument about Medicare for All. But when her I think it was reported at the maybe it was you, I think, who actually reported this, if I'm not mistaken, when Wendell Primus, her top advisor on health care, gets in front of a health conference a year and a half ago and says, we're not going to do Medicare for All. That leads me to believe that that's not a function of worrying about frontline Democrats, none of whom existed at that time, really, because the wave had not happened. But really, it's more about, like, who's paying my bills or what my political predisposition is.
I mean, yeah, as I said, Nancy Pelosi has put herself on the side of capital. She has put herself on the side of industry, and she has said, this is where I'm going to stay. And it's up to those who don't agree with that stance to find a way around it.
All right, folks. Dave and I will discuss this more, I imagine, in the future. But for now, thanks so much for your time, Dave. Fascinating stuff.
All right. Thank you.
David Dayne is the executive editor of The American Prospect. His work has appeared in The Intercept, The New Republic, HuffPost, and The Washington Post, and The Los Angeles Times, and more. Check them out at prospect.org. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You are listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show and hear what you've been missing.